Give it more time, I told her. As I said before, soon it'll be spring and everything will look different then, you'll see. She nodded briskly, wanting to believe it. Then she kicked her shoes across the mat again and, with a sigh of reluctance, headed back into the chill and gloomy house to rejoin her mother. I found myself recalling that sigh a day or two later, as I was making my arrangements for the district hospital dance. The dance was an annual event, meant as a fundraiser. No one except the younger people treated it very seriously, but the local doctors liked to attend, along with their wives and grown-up children. We Lidcote physicians took it in turns to go along, and this year it was the turn of Graham and me, while our locum, Frank Wise, and Dr. Seeley's partner, Morrison, remained on call. As a bachelor, I was at liberty to take along a guest or two, and a few months earlier, thinking ahead to the night, I'd actually considered asking Mrs. Ayres. Now that she was still so relatively unwell, her attendance was out of the question. But it occurred to me that Caroline might be willing to partner me, if it was for the sake of an evening away from hundreds. Of course, I thought it just as possible she'd be appalled to be asked along at the last minute to what was essentially a work's due, and I dithered over whether or not to suggest it. But I'd forgotten that ironic streak of hers. "A doctor's dance?" she said, delighted, when I finally called her up to invite her. "Oh, I should love to!" "Are you sure? It's a funny old event. And it's more of a nurse's dance than a doctor's. The women usually far outnumber the men."
"I bet they do. All pink and hysterical at being let off the wards, just like the junior wrens used to be at naval parties. Does matron drink too much and disgrace herself with the surgeons? Oh, say she does."
"Now steady on," I said, "or there'll be no surprises." She laughed, and even over the imperfect telephone line I could hear the note of real pleasure in her voice, and I was glad I'd asked her. I don't know if, in agreeing to be my guest, she had any other motive in mind. It would be odd, I suppose, for an unmarried woman of her age to look forward to a dance without giving a thought to the single men who might be there. But if her ideas were running that way, she hid them well. Perhaps her little humiliation with Mr. Morley had taught her to be cautious. She spoke about the dance as if she and I would be a pair of elderly lookers-on at the fun, and when I picked her up on the night in question I found her dressed very unshowily, in an olive-coloured sleeveless gown, with her hair hanging loose and uncurled, her throat and hands, as usual, bare, and her heavy face almost free of make-up. We left Mrs. Ayres in the little parlour, apparently not at all unhappy to have an evening to herself. She had a tray across her lap and was going through some old letters of her husband's, putting them in neat, ordered bundles. Still, I felt awkward about leaving her alone. "Will your mother really be all right?" I asked Caroline, as she and I set off. She said,
"Oh, she has Betty, don't forget. Betty will sit with her for hours. They've started playing games together, did you know that? Mother came across some old boards when we were going through the house. They play draughts and halma."
"Betty and your mother?"
"I know. It's queer, isn't it? I don't remember Mother ever wanting to play board games with Roddy and me. She seems to like it now, though. Betty likes it, too. They play for halfpennies, and Mother lets her win. I don't think Betty had much fun at home over Christmas, poor thing. Her own mother sounds frightful, so I suppose it isn't surprising she prefers mine. And people do like Mother. It's just one of those things."
She yawned as she said this, and drew in her coat against the cold. And after a while, lulled by the sound and motion of the car, for it was almost a 30-minute drive to Leamington on the wintry country roads, we lapsed into companionable silence. But once we reached the hospital grounds and joined the stir of vehicles and people, we both perked up. The dance was held in one of the lecture halls, a large room with a parquet floor. Tonight it had been cleared of its desks and benches, its harsh central lights were turned off, and pretty coloured lamps and bunting had been draped from beam to beam. A band, not terribly good, was playing an instrumental number when we went in. The slippery floor had been liberally powdered with chalk, and several obliging couples were already up and dancing. Other people sat at tables around the edge, getting up their nerve to join them. A long trestle arrangement did service as a bar. We started across towards it, but after only a few yards I was hailed by a couple of colleagues, Bland and Rickett, one a surgeon, the other a Leamington GP. I introduced them to Caroline, and they followed the usual sort of chat. They had paper cups in their hands, and seeing me glancing at the bar, Rickett said,
"Headed for the chloroform punch? Don't be taken in by the name. It's like flat cherryade. Hang on a sec. Here's the fellow we need."
He reached around Caroline's back to catch hold of somebody by the arm. The man was a porter. "Our resident Spiv," Bland explained to Caroline, while Rickett murmured in the man's ear. The porter went off and returned a minute later with four more cups, each brimful of the watery pink liquid I could see being ladled out from the punch bowls at the bar, but each, too, as soon became apparent, rather stiffly laced with brandy.
"Vastly improved," said Rickett, having tasted and smacked his lips. "Don't you think so, miss?"
He had forgotten Caroline's name. The brandy was rough, and the punch itself had been sweetened with saccharin. When Bland and Rickett had moved on, I said to Caroline, "Can you drink this stuff?" She was laughing.
"I'm not going to waste it after all that. Is it really black?"
"Probably."
"How shocking!"
"Well, I dare say a bit of black brandy won't do us any harm." I put my hand to the small of her back to steer her out of the traffic of people going to and from the bar. The hall was filling up. We began the search for a vacant table, but soon another man greeted me, one of the consultants this time, and, as it happened, the man to whom I'd submitted my paper on the successful treatment of Rod's leg. There was no question of my not stopping for him, and he ran on for 10 or 15 minutes, wanting my opinion of some therapeutic process of his own. He made little effort to include Caroline, and I kept glancing at her as he spoke. She was gazing around the hall, taking rapid sips from her paper cup, self-conscious. But from time to time, too, she looked at me as the man addressed me, as if seeing me in a slightly new way.
"You're quite the somebody here,"
she said to me, when the consultant had finally moved on.
"Ha!"
I took a mouthful of punch. "Quite the nobody, I assure you."
"Well, then we can be nobodies together. It makes a nice change from home. I can't go into any of the villages these days without feeling everyone's watching me, thinking, 'There goes poor Miss Ayres from up at the Hall.' And now, look!"
She had turned her head.
"All the nurses have arrived in a great big flock, just as I pictured them, like blushing goslings. I thought of nursing, you know, during the war. So many people told me I was just cut out for it, it put me off. I couldn't make that out as a compliment, somehow. That's why I joined the Wrens. Then I ended up nursing Roddy."
Catching the touch of wistfulness in her voice, I said, "Did you miss it, service life?" She nodded.
"Badly at first. I was good at it, you see. That's a shameful thing to admit, isn't it? But I liked all the mucking about with boats. I liked the routines of it. I liked there being only one way to do things, only one sort of stocking, one sort of shoe, one sort of way to wear one's hair. I was going to stay on at the end of the war, go out to Italy or Singapore. But once I was back at Hundreds..."
Her arm jolted, as a man and a girl pushed hastily past her. Her drink slopped. She raised the cup to her mouth to catch the drips with her tongue, and after that she was silent. The band had been joined by a singer, and the music was louder and livelier. People were moving in some excitement to the dance floor, making it harder for us to stand and talk. Raising my voice above the music, I said, "Let's not stay here. Why don't I find you someone to dance with? There's Mr. Andrews, the house surgeon." She touched my arm.
"Oh, don't introduce me to any more men just yet, especially not to a surgeon. Every time he looks at me, I should be thinking he's sizing me up for the knife. Besides, men hate dancing with tall women. You and I can dance, can't we?"
I said, "Of course, if you like." We finished our drinks, set down our cups, and made our way onto the floor. There was an awkward moment as we put up our arms and moved together, trying to overcome the essential artificiality of the pose and join the jostling, unwelcoming crowd. Caroline said,
"I hate this bit. It's like having to hurl oneself onto a paternoster lift."
"Close your eyes, then," I answered, and guided her out in a quick step. After a moment of being clipped and scuffed by the heels and elbows of other dancers, we found the rhythm of the crowd and a route through it. She opened her eyes, impressed.
"But how on earth will we get off again?"
"Don't worry about that just yet."
"We'll have to wait for the slow numbers. You dance rather well, in fact."
"So do you."
"You sound surprised. I love to dance. I always have. I danced like mad in the war. It was the very best thing about it, all that dancing. When I was young, I danced with my father. He was so tall, it didn't matter that I was tall, too. He taught me all my steps. Rod was hopeless. He said I heaved him about. He might as well have been dancing with a boy. I'm not heaving you about, am I?"
"Not at all."
"And I'm not talking too much? I know some men don't like that. I gather it puts them off their stroke."
I said she could talk as much as she liked. The fact is, I was delighted to see her in such good spirits, and to feel her so relaxed, so yielding and mobile in my arms. We kept a slight formal distance between us, but every now and then the pressure of the crowd would send her more firmly into my grip, and I'd feel the spring of her full bosom against my chest, the solid push of her hips. As we made a turn, the muscular flesh of her lower back would tense and shift beneath my palm and outspread fingers. Her hand in mine was sticky from the spilled punch. Once she turned her head to look across the dance floor, and I caught the scent of brandy on her mouth. I realized that she was slightly drunk. Perhaps I was slightly drunk, too, but I felt a rush of fondness for her, so sudden and so simple it made me smile. She put back her head to look into my face.
"Why are you grinning like that? You look like a dancer in a contest. Have they pinned a number on your back?"
She peered over my shoulder, pretending to check. Again her bosom came springily against me. Then she spoke into my ear.
"There's Dr. Seeley. Whiz me round so you can see his bow tie and his buttonhole."
I made a turn and caught sight of the man, large and bearish, dancing with his wife. The tie was a polka-dotted one, the flower some sort of fleshy orchid. Goodness knows where he'd got hold of it. A blade of hair, over-greased, had fallen forward over his brow. I said,
"He thinks he's Oscar Wilde."
"Oscar Wilde!"
Caroline laughed. I felt the laughter in my arms.
"If only he were! When I was young, the girls called him the Octopus. He was always terribly keen to give one a lift, and no matter how many hands he had on the steering wheel, there always seemed to be at least one more. Guide me away where he can't see us. You still have to dish out all the gossip, don't forget. Keep to the edge of the floor."
"Look here, who's leading? I'm beginning to think I know what Roderick meant when he said you heaved him about."
"Keep to the edge,"
she said, laughing again.
"And as we go round, you can tell me who everybody is, and who has killed the most patients, and which doctors are going to bed with which nurses, and all the scandals."
So we stayed on the floor through two or three more songs, and I did my best to point out the major hospital personalities, and to offer up a few mild pieces of gossip. After that, the music reverted to a waltz, and the dancing thinned. We moved back to the bar for more punch. The hall was growing warmer. Looking up, I saw David Graham just arrived with Anne and making his way through the crowd in our direction, and thinking of the last time he and Caroline had met, when he had come up to Hundreds to second my opinion of Roderick, the day before Rod was taken from the house. I leaned close to her and said as quietly as I could over the music, "Here's Graham headed our way. Will you mind seeing him?" She didn't look, but gave a small, tight shake of her head.
"No, I don't mind. I guessed he'd be here."
The slight awkwardness of the Grahams' arrival, anyway, was soon dispelled. They had brought guests, a middle-aged Stratford man and his wife and their married daughter, and the daughter and Caroline turned out to be old friends. Laughing and exclaiming, they moved together to exchange kisses.
"We knew each other," Caroline told me. "Oh, years ago, way back in the war."
The daughter, Brenda, was blonde, good-looking, rather worldly-looking, too, I thought. I was pleased for Caroline's sake that she had turned up, but also vaguely sorry, for with her and her parents' arrival it was as if a line were drawn between the older people and the younger. She and Caroline stood slightly apart from the rest of us, and lit cigarettes, and soon they linked arms and headed off in the direction of the ladies. By the time they returned, I'd been thoroughly claimed by the Graham party, who had found a table away from the blare of the band and produced a couple of bottles of Algerian wine. Cups of this were given to Caroline and Brenda, and chairs offered, but they wouldn't sit. They stood looking over the dance floor, Brenda swinging her hips impatiently to the rhythm of the music as she drank. The tunes were picking up again, and they both wanted to dance.
"You don't mind?"
Caroline asked apologetically, as she moved away.
"Brenda knows some people here she wants to introduce me."
"You go and dance," I said.
"I shan't be long, I promise."
"It's good to see Caroline out and about enjoying herself,"
Graham said to me when she had gone. I nodded.
"Yes." "You and she see a lot of each other?"
I said, "Well, I call in whenever I can at the house."
"Of course,"
he answered, as if having waited for me to say more, and then, more confidentially,
"No progress with the brother, I suppose?"
I gave him the latest report I'd had from Dr. Warren. We passed from that to exchanging news about one or two of our other patients, and from that to a discussion with the Stratford man of the forthcoming health service. The Stratford man, like most GPs, was violently opposed to it. David Graham was passionately for it, while I was still gloomily convinced it would mean the end of my career, so the debate was pretty lively and went on for some time. Every so often I'd lift my head and look for Caroline on the dance floor. Now and then she and Brenda returned to the table for more wine. "Okay," I called to her, or mouthed to her over Graham's shoulder. "I'm not neglecting you." She'd shake her head, smiling.
"Don't be silly."
"Do you really think Caroline's all right?" I asked Anne as the evening wore on. "I feel I've rather abandoned her." She glanced at her husband and said something that didn't quite carry over the music, something like,
"Oh, we're used to that,"
or even,
"She'll have to get used to that."
Something, anyway, that gave me the impression she had misheard me. But seeing the puzzlement on my face, she added, laughing,
"Brenda's looking after her, don't worry, she's fine."
But then at 11:30 or so, someone got hold of the microphone to announce a Paul Jones, and there was a general migration to the dance floor, which Graham and I were persuaded to join. Automatically I looked for Caroline again and saw her being pulled into the women's circle on the other side of the hall. After that I kept my eye on her, hoping to coincide with her at the breaks of music. But with every reshuffle we'd go galloping towards each other, only to be helplessly tugged away in opposite directions. The ring of women, swollen with nurses, was fuller than the ring of men. I saw her smile and almost stumble as her feet tangled with the other girls, and once, as she flew past me, she caught my eye and grimaced.
"This is murder,"
I think she called. The next time she came, she was laughing. Her loose hair had fallen forwards and was clinging in darkening strands to the sheen of perspiration on her face and lips. At last she finished a place or two to my left, and in the polite but determined jostling that followed, I moved to claim her, only to be beaten to her side by a large, damp, hot-looking man I recognized after a second as Jim Seeley. He was, I think, her rightful partner in the ring, but she gave me an alarmed, comical look as he drew her into a close embrace, then led her off in a slow foxtrot with his chin against her ear. I danced that number with one of the younger nurses, and when it ended and the circles formed more rowdily than before, I left the floor. I went to the bar for another cup of watery punch, then moved out of the thickest part of the crowd to watch the dancing. Caroline, I saw, had extricated herself from Seeley and found a less overbearing partner, a young man in horn glasses. Seeley himself, like me, had given up on the floor altogether in favour of the bar. He had knocked back his punch and was taking out cigarettes and a lighter, and, happening to look up and catch my eye as he did it, he came over to offer me his case.
"On nights like this I feel my age, Faraday," he said, when our cigarettes were lit. "Don't these damn nurses seem young to you? I swear, there's a little thing I danced with earlier on. She looked barely older than my 12-year-old daughter. That's all right for a filthy old pervert like—"
And here he named one of the senior surgeons who'd been at the centre of a minor scandal a year or two before.
"But when I'm dancing with a girl and I ask her how she likes the district, and she tells me it reminds her of the place she was evacuated to in 1940, well, it's hardly conducive to romance. As for all this thundering about in circles, I'd sooner an old-fashioned waltz. I suppose they'll break out the rumbas in a minute. God help us then."
He took out a handkerchief and mopped his face, then passed the handkerchief under his collar and wiped all round his neck. His throat was scarlet, his bow tie limp. His orchid was lost, I noticed now, only the fleshy green stalk of it remaining at his lapel, slightly milky at the tip. Fueled by drink and exercise, he gave off heat like a brazier, so that it was impossible to stand beside him in that overwarm hall and not want to move away. But having accepted one of his cigarettes, I thought it only fair to keep him company while I smoked it. So he mopped and puffed and grumbled on for another minute or two, then our gazes moved naturally back to the dance floor, and we both fell silent, watching the couples jog by. I didn't see Caroline at first, and thought she might have left the floor, but she was dancing still with the young man in glasses, and once my eyes had found her out, they tended to return to her. The Paul Jones had finished, and this dance was more sedate, but there was a general air of subsiding hilarity, and Caroline, like everybody else, was damp in the face, her hair untidy, her shoes and stockings streaked with chalk, her throat and the flesh of her arms still flushed and glowing. The heightened colour suited her, I thought. For all that her dress was so unshowy and her pose so plain, she looked very young, as if her youth had been whipped to the surface by motion and laughter along with her blood. I watched her through all of that dance, and into the start of another, and only when Seeley spoke did I realize that he had been watching her too. He said, "Caroline Ayres looks well." I took a step away from him to stub out my cigarette at the nearest table. Moving back, I said, "Yes, doesn't she?"
"She's a good dancer, that girl. Knows she's got hips and what to do with them. Most English women dance from the feet."
His tone and expression grew more speculative.
"You've seen her on horseback, I suppose. There's something there, definitely. A pity she doesn't have the looks to match. Still,"
he took a last draw on his cigarette,
"I shouldn't let that put you off."
For a second I thought I had misheard him. Then I saw by his face that I had not. He saw my expression, too. He had pursed his lips to direct away a plume of smoke. But he laughed, and the plume grew ragged.
"Oh, come on! It's no secret, is it, how much time you've been spending with that family? I don't mind telling you, there's quite a little debate locally as to which of the women you've set your sights on, the daughter or the mother."
He spoke as if the whole thing were a tremendous joke, as if amusedly egging me on in some ambitious piece of mischief, like a prefect applauding a junior boy for having the pluck to peep through matron's window. I said coldly, "What terrific fun for you all." But he laughed again.
"Don't take it like that. You know what village life is like. Almost as bad as hospital life. We're all so many bloody prisoners. We have to take our entertainment where we can get it. Personally, I don't know why you've been dragging your heels. Mrs. Ayres has been a handsome woman in her day, I'll give you that. But if I were you, I'd plump for Caroline, purely on the basis, you know, of her having so many good years left in her."
His words, as I recall them now, strike me as so offensive I'm astonished to think that I stood there, letting him say them, gazing into his boozy, hot, red face, without wanting to punch him. But what impressed me most at the time, still, was that hint of condescension. I felt I was being made an ass of, and it seemed to me that to strike him would only serve to give him the satisfaction that I was, at root, what he supposed me to be, a sort of rustic booby. So I stood tensely, saying nothing, wanting to shut him up, but not quite knowing how. He saw my confusion and actually nudged me.
"Set you thinking, have I? Well, make your move tonight, old man."
He gestured to the dance floor.
"Before that twerp in the horn rims gets a chance to make his. After all, it's a long, dark drive back to Hundreds."
At last I woke up. "I think I see your wife," I said, nodding over his shoulder into the crowd. He blinked and turned, and I moved away from him, finding an awkward, interrupted route around the tables and chairs. I was heading for the door, meaning to stand for a minute or two in the chill night air. But as I went, I passed close to the table I had been sharing with the Grahams, and the Stratford couple, seeing me going by with such a fixed expression, naturally assumed I'd lost my way back to my seat and called out to me. They looked so pleased by my return. The wife walked with a cane and was kept from the dancing, that I hadn't the heart to press on, but rejoined their table and stayed talking to them, then, for the rest of the night. What we talked about, I have no idea. I was so thrown by what Seeley had said, and in such a mixture of ways I could hardly sort out my own feelings. The fact that I had brought Caroline there, with no thought for how the thing would look, seemed suddenly incredible. I suppose I'd grown used to the idea of spending time with her, out in the isolation of Hundreds, and if I'd once or twice had a surge of feeling for her, well, that was one of those things brought on, between men and women, by simple closeness, like matches sparking as they jostled in the box. To think that all this time people had been watching us, speculating, rubbing their hands. It made me feel fooled, somehow. It made me feel exposed. A part of my upset, I'm sorry to say, was simple embarrassment, a basic masculine reluctance to have my name romantically linked with that of a notoriously plain girl. Part of it was shame at discovering I felt this. A contradictory part, too, was pride, for why the hell shouldn't I asked myself, bring Caroline Ayres along to a party if I chose to? Why the hell shouldn't I dance with the squire's daughter if the squire's daughter wanted to dance with me? And mixed up with it all was a kind of nervous possessiveness of Caroline herself, that seemed to have leapt upon me from nowhere. I recalled the smirk on Seeley's face as he watched her moving about the floor. "Knows she's got hips and what to do with them. You've seen her on horseback, I suppose?" I should have hit him when I had the chance, I thought furiously. I would certainly have hit him now if he'd come and said the same thing again. I even peered around the hall with the crazy idea of going after him. I couldn't see him. He wasn't dancing, he wasn't standing looking on. But I couldn't see Caroline either, nor the boy with the horn rims. That began to bother me. I was still politely chatting with a Stratford couple, still sharing cigarettes and wine, but as we talked, my eyes must have been darting. The dancing looked nonsensical to me now, the dancers themselves like gesturing lunatics. All I wanted was for Caroline to emerge from the jolting, red-faced crowd so that I could put her into her coat and take her home. Finally, at just after one, when the music had finished and the lights had come up, she reappeared at the table. She came with Brenda, both of them fresh from the dance floor, with blurred eyes and mouths. She stood a couple of feet away from me, yawning and plucking at the bodice of her dress to free it from the tug of moist skin beneath, exposing an edge of brassiere strap at her armpit. Exposing the armpit itself. A muscular hollow, shadowed with fine stubble and faintly streaked with talcum. And though I had longed for her return, when she met my gaze and smiled, I felt, unaccountably, the sting of something that was almost anger, and had to turn away from her. I told her, rather stiffly, that I would fetch our things from the cloakroom, and she and Brenda went off again to the ladies. When they came back, still yawning, I was relieved to see that she had tidied her hair, and made a neat, conventional mask of her face and throat with lipstick and powder. "God, what a fright I looked," she said, as I helped her into her coat. She gazed around the hall, up into the rafters at the bunting, which had revealed itself in all its faded V.E. colours.
"A bit like this place. Isn't it awful how the glamour goes, once the lights come on? Still, I wish we didn't have to leave. A girl was crying in the lavatory. I suppose one of you beastly doctors has broken her heart."
Without meeting her gaze, I nodded to her coat, which she'd left unfastened. "You ought to do that up. It'll be freezing outside. Didn't you bring a scarf?"
"I forgot."
"Well, close your lapels, will you?" She drew the coat together with one hand and slipped the other through my arm. She did it lightly, but I wished she hadn't done it at all. We stood saying our goodbyes to the Grahams, to the Stratford couple, and to the blonde, worldly Brenda, and I felt horribly self-conscious, imagining I could see mirth in all their gazes, and guessing what they were thinking as they watched us heading off together for, as Celia had put it, the long, dark drive back to hundreds. Then I remembered the queer thing Anne Graham had laughingly said when I'd asked after Caroline, that Caroline would have to get used to being abandoned, as if she were soon to be a doctor's wife. That made me more self-conscious still. When we had said good night and were crossing the emptying hall, I found a way of handing Caroline before me so that our arms became disengaged. Out in the car park, the ground was so frosty and the cold so instantly penetrating, she caught hold of me again. "I warned you you'd freeze," I said.
"Either that or break a leg," she answered. "I'm in heels, don't forget. Oh, help!"
She stumbled and laughed and seized my arm with both her hands to draw herself even closer. The gesture jarred with me. She had had that brandy early in the evening, and after that a glass or two of wine, and I'd been glad to see her, as I'd thought of it then, letting off steam. But where, for those first few dances, she'd been genuinely loose and tipsy in my arms, it seemed to me now that her giddiness had something just slightly forced about it. She said again,
"Oh, isn't it a shame we have to leave?"
But she said it too brightly. It was as if she wanted more from the night than the night had so far given her, and was broadening and hardening her strokes against it in an effort to make it pay up. Once more before we reached my car she stumbled, or pretended to, and when I got her inside and put a blanket around her shoulders she sat and shivered unrestrainedly, her teeth chattering like dice in a cup. Since my car had no heater, I had brought along a hot water bottle for her, and a thermos of water with which to fill it. I saw to that and handed it over, and she tucked it gratefully inside her coat. But as I started the engine, she wound down her window and, still shivering, stuck out her head. I said,
"What on earth are you doing?" "I'm looking at the stars. They're rather brilliant."
"Well, for God's sake, look with the window up. You'll catch a chill." She laughed.
"You sound almost like a doctor."
"And you," I said, catching hold of her sleeve and pulling her back in, "sound almost like the silly young girl I know for a fact you're not. Now sit up straight and close your window." She did as she was told. Suddenly meek, perhaps chastened by the note of irritation in my voice, perhaps puzzled by it. I was puzzled by it myself, for the fact is she had done nothing to deserve it. It was all filthy-minded Seeley's fault, and I had let him walk away. We drove without speaking out of the hospital grounds, part of a lively gush of traffic at first, but soon breaking free of the tooting horns, the cheers and calls and bicycle bells, and entering quieter roads. Caroline sat huddled in the blanket, and little by little, as she grew warmer, I felt her long limbs begin to loosen. My mood softened slightly in response. "Better?" I asked.
"Yes, thank you," she replied.
By now we had left the outskirts of Leamington and passed into unlit country lanes. The ground was frostier here, the road and hedges white and sparkling. They seemed to part around our headlamps, to froth and rush back into darkness, like water churned by the prow of a boat. Caroline gazed for a time through the windscreen, then rubbed her eyes.
"The road's hypnotizing me. Don't you mind it?"
I said, "I'm used to it." She seemed struck by that.
"Yes," she said, looking at me. "Of course you are, driving through the night. How people must listen out for your car, and watch for the headlamps, and how glad they must be when you arrive. If we were dashing to a bedside now, how badly those people would be longing for us. I never thought of that before. Doesn't it almost frighten you?"
I reached to change gear. "Why should it frighten me?"
"The responsibility of it, I suppose."
I said, "I told you before, I'm a nobody. People don't even see me half the time. They see Doctor. They see the bag. The bag's the thing. Old Dr. Gill told me that. My father bought me a fine new leather bag when I first qualified. Gill took one look at it and said I wouldn't get anywhere with a thing like that. No one would trust me. He gave me a battered old bag of his own. I used it for years."
"Still," she said after a moment, as if she hadn't been listening, "how those people must watch and wait and want you. Perhaps you like it. Is that it?"
I glanced at her through the darkness. "Is what what?"
"Do you like it, that there's always someone longing for you in the night?"
I didn't make her any answer. She didn't seem to want any. More than ever, I had the feeling of there being something false about her, as if she were playing on the dark, dislocated intimacy of the car to try out another personality. Brenda's personality, perhaps. She was silent for a moment, then started humming. It was one of the songs she had danced to with the young man in glasses, and realizing that, I felt my mood harden again. She reached for her evening bag and fumbled for something inside.
"Is your car one of those lighter things?" she asked, bringing out a packet of cigarettes.
Her hand moved palely over the dashboard, then drew back.
"Never mind. I've matches here somewhere. Shall I light one for you?"
I said, "I can light my own if you'll pass it to me."
"Oh, let me do it. It'll be just like in the pictures."
There came the rasp and flare of a match, and from the corner of my eye I saw her face and hands spring into luminous life. She had two cigarettes at her mouth. She lit them both, then took one from between her lips and reached across to put it between mine. Faintly disturbed by the sudden brush of her cold fingers, and by the dry nudge of the cigarette, which had a suggestion of lipstick about it, I at once took it out again and held it at the steering wheel. We smoked in silence for a while. She put her face close to her window and started drawing lines and circles where her breath clouded the glass. Then, abruptly, she said,
"That girl Brenda I met tonight, I don't much like her, you know."
I said, "You don't? I'd never have guessed. You greeted each other like long-lost sisters."
"Oh, women always go on like that."
"Yes, I've often thought it must be exhausting to be a woman."
"It is, if you do it properly, which is why I so seldom do. Do you know how I know her?"
"Brenda? I imagined from the Wrens."
"No, from just before that. We fire-watched together for about 6 weeks, that's all. We were not at all alike, but I suppose the boredom made us talk. She'd been seeing a boy, sleeping with him, I mean, and she'd just found out that she was pregnant. She wanted to get rid of it, and she was after a girl to go with her to a chemist's and help her buy some stuff, and I said I'd go. We went into Birmingham, where no one knew us. The man was horrible. Prim and withering and excited, just as you'd expect. I can never decide if it's reassuring when people turn out to be just what one's expected, or depressing, The stuff worked, though.
Reaching to change gear again, I said, I doubt that it did, actually. That sort of stuff hardly ever does.
No, said Caroline, surprised. Just a coincidence, then?
Just a coincidence.
Just a bit of good luck for good old Brenda. And after all that. But Brenda's the sort of person that luck happens to, good luck and bad. Some people are like that, don't you think?
She drew on her cigarette.
She asked who you were.
What? Who did?
Brenda did. She thought you might be my stepfather. And when I told her you weren't, she looked at you again with a horrid narrowing of her eyes and said, "Your sugar father, then." That's the way her mind works.
Christ, I thought. That seemed to be the way that everyone's mind worked. And I supposed it was a marvellous joke to all of them. I said, "Well, I hope you swiftly put her right." She didn't answer. She was still drawing lines on the window. "Well, did you?"
Oh, I let her think it for a minute. Just for a minute, just for the fun of trying it out. She must have remembered that time in Birmingham, too. She said the best of its being a medical man was one was never so afraid of tripping up. I said, "My dear, you needn't tell me. I've sprained my ankle 4 times. Doctor's been a lamb."
She took another puff on her cigarette, then spoke flatly.
"I didn't really. I told her the truth. That you were a friend of the family, being kind, taking me dancing as a treat. I think she thought rather the worse of me for it."
"She sounds like a thoroughly unpleasant young woman." She laughed.
"How prim you are. Most young women talk like that. To other young women, I mean. I told you. I've never much liked her. God, my feet are perished."
She fidgeted about for a second, trying to warm herself up. I realized she was kicking her shoes off. Soon she hitched up her legs and tucked the skirts of her dress and coat behind her knees and turned sideways towards me, setting her stockinged feet down over the slight gap between her seat and mine. Reaching forward with her hands, one of them with a half-smoked cigarette in it, she caught hold of her toes and began to chafe them. She kept this up for a minute or two, finally getting rid of the cigarette in the dashboard ashtray, then breathing into her palms and laying them flat and still on the back of her feet. After that, she was silent. She tucked in her head and seemed to doze. Or perhaps she only pretended to sleep. At a turn in the road, I felt the car meet a patch of ice and glide a foot or two across it. I had to pump the brake and slow almost to a standstill, which surely would have roused her if she'd been slumbering naturally. But she didn't stir. A little later I stopped for a crossroads and turned to look at her. Her eyes were still closed, and in the darkness, in her dark dress and coat, she seemed an assemblage of angular fragments. The squarish face with its heavy brows, the full red diamond of her mouth, her uncovered throat, her muscular calves, those long, pale hands. The fragments shifted as she opened her eyes. She held my gaze. Her own gaze gleaming very slightly in the reflected sparkle of the frosty road. When she spoke, the touch of brashness had gone from her voice. She sounded flat, almost unhappy. She said,
"The first time you gave me a lift in this car, we ate blackberries. Do you remember?"
I put the car into gear and moved on. Of course I remember. I felt her eyes still on my face. She turned to her window and peered out.
"Where are we now?"
"On the Hundreds Road."
"As close as that?"
"You must be tired."
"I'm not. Not really."
"Not after all that dancing? All those young men?"
"The dancing woke me up," she said, in the same subdued tone as before. "Though it's true that one or two of the young men nearly put me to sleep again."
I opened my mouth to speak, then closed it. Then spoke anyway. "What about the fellow with the specs?" She turned back to me, curious.
"You saw him, did you? He was the worst. Alan, or Alec, I suppose it might have been. He said he works in one of the hospital laboratories. Tried to make it sound frightfully technical and important, but I don't think it can be. He lives in town with his mum and dad. That's as much as I know. He couldn't really talk while he was dancing. He couldn't really dance either."
She lowered her head again so that her cheek touched the back of her seat, and again I found myself struggling with a curious mix of emotions. I said, with a touch of bitterness, "Poor little Alan or Alec." But she didn't catch the change in my voice. She had drawn in her chin so that when she spoke again her words were muted. She said, "I don't think I enjoyed any of the dances, actually, so much as the ones that you and I had at the start." I didn't answer. She went on after a pause, "I wish we had some more of that black brandy. Don't you keep a flask of something in the car?" And she reached and opened up a pocket in the dashboard and started feeling about inside, among the papers and spanners and empty cigarette packets. I said, "Please don't do that."
"Why not? Have you a secret? There's nothing there, anyway."
She closed the pocket with a snap, then turned to look over at the back seat. The hot water bottle fell out of her coat and went slithering to the floor. She had grown lively again.
"Isn't there anything in your bag?"
"Don't be silly."
"There must be something."
"You can have some ethyl chloride, if you like."
"That would put me to sleep, wouldn't it? I don't want to go to sleep. I might as well be back at Hundreds, then." "God, I don't want to go back to Hundreds. Take me somewhere else, can't you?"
She moved about like a child, and either with that or simply with the jolting of the car, her feet crept further over the gap between our seats until I could just make out the small, blunt movement of her toes against my thigh. I said uneasily, "Your mother will be waiting for you, Caroline."
"Oh, Mother doesn't care. She'll have gone to bed and put Betty to wait. Besides, they know I'm with you. The noble chaperone and all that. It won't matter how late we are."
I glanced at her. "You're not serious. It's past 2 o'clock. I have my surgery at 9.
"We might stop the car, go for a walk."
"You're in dancing shoes."
"I don't want to go home yet, that's all. Couldn't we drive somewhere? Sit, smoke more cigarettes?"
"Drive where?"
"Drive anywhere. You must know a place."
"Don't be silly," I said again. But I said it rather weakly, for despite myself, as if the image had been waiting just under the surface of my mind, and now at her words sprang upwards, despite myself I thought of that spot I sometimes drove to, the dark pond with its border of rushes. I imagined the smooth, starred water, the grass silvered and crisp underfoot, the hush and stillness of the place. The turning was a mile or two ahead, that was all. Perhaps she sensed some change in me. She stopped moving about, and we fell into a tight sort of silence. The road rose, then curved and dipped. Another minute, and we were approaching the entrance to the lane. I really didn't know, I think, until the very last moment, whether I would make the turn or not. Then abruptly I slowed and put in the clutch and changed hastily down the gears. Beside me, Caroline reached out a hand to the dashboard to brace herself against the turn. She'd expected it even less than I had. Her feet slid further forward with the motion of the car, so that for a second I felt them right under my thigh, solid and purposeful as burrowing creatures. Then we ran more smoothly, and she drew them back, and her seat creaked and tilted as she pressed her heels to keep them from sliding further. Had she meant it when she'd talked of sitting, smoking cigarettes? Had I, in picturing this place, somehow forgotten that it was 2 o'clock in the morning? With the fading of the headlamps that came when I turned off the engine, there was nothing to be seen of the pond, the grass, the circling rushes. We might have been anywhere, or nowhere at all. Only the hush was as I'd imagined it, a hush so deep it seemed to magnify every sound which broke it, so that I was unnaturally aware of the movement of Caroline's breath, of the tightening and unclenching of her throat as she swallowed, of the unsticking of her tongue and palate as she slightly opened her mouth. For a minute, perhaps longer, we sat with no more motion between us than that, I with my hands on the steering wheel, she with her arm out to the dashboard as if still bracing herself against jars. Then I turned and tried to look at her. It was too dark to make her out properly. But I could picture vividly enough her face, with its unhandsome combination of strong family lines. I heard again Celia's words, "There's something there, definitely." Oh, I had felt it, hadn't I? I think I had felt it the very first time I'd met her, watching her work her bare brown toes through the fur of Jip's belly, and I had felt it 100 times since then, catching sight of the flare of her hips, the swell of her bosom, the easy, solid movement of her limbs. But again I was ashamed to acknowledge it. Am ashamed to remember it now. The feeling stirred something else in me, some dark current of unease, almost of distaste. It wasn't the difference in our ages. I don't think I even considered that. It was as if what pulled me to her also repelled me, as if I desired her despite myself. I thought again of Seeley. None of this, I knew, would have made any sense to him. Seeley would have kissed her and to hell with it. I've imagined that kiss many times, the chill of her lip, and the surprise of the heat beyond it, the teasing open in the darkness of a seam of moisture, movement, taste. Seeley would have done it. But I am not Seeley. It was a long time since I had kissed a woman, years, in fact, since I had held a woman in my arms with anything other than a rather perfunctory passion. I had a brief flare of panic. Suppose I had lost the trick of it. And here was Caroline, beside me, possibly as uncertain as myself, but youthful, alive, tense, expectant. At last I took my hand from the steering wheel and placed it tentatively upon one of her feet. The toes shifted as if tickled, but apart from that she made no response. I kept the hand there for perhaps 6 or 7 heartbeats, and then slowly I moved it. Just moved my fingers across the fine, unresisting surface of her stocking, up over the arch of her foot, and the jut of her ankle bone, and into the dip of heel behind it. When again she kept quite still, I inched the hand steadily higher, until it was held in the cleft, slightly warm, slightly moist, between her calf and the back of her thigh. And then I turned and leaned towards her, putting out my other hand, meaning to catch at her shoulder and draw her face to mine. But the hand in the darkness found the lapel of her coat. My thumb slid just beyond the inner edge of it and met the start of the swell of her breast. I thought she flinched or shivered as the thumb moved lightly over her gown. Again I heard the movement of her tongue inside her mouth, the parting of her lips, an indrawn breath. The gown had 3 pearl buttons to it, and I awkwardly opened them up. Beneath was a slip, some over-laundered thing with a limp lace trim. Beneath that was her brassiere, solid, unfussy, severely elasticated, the kind of thing I'd seen many times on female patients since the war, so that for a moment, recalling those unerotic consulting-room scenes, my faltering desire almost dwindled completely. But then she moved, or took a breath. Her breast lifted into my hand, and I became aware, not of the stiffly tailored cup of the brassiere, but of the warm, full flesh inside it, hard at the tip. Hard, it seemed to me, as the point of one of her own shapely fingers. That somehow gave the missing charge to my desire, and I leaned further into her, my hat slipping from my head. The leg which gripped my left hand I eased open and drew behind me. Her other leg came across my lap, heavy and warm. I put my face to her breast, and then must have reached for her mouth. I moved awkwardly over and upon her, wanting to kiss her, that was all. But she gave a sort of buck, and her chin clipped my head. She shifted her legs, shifted them further. It took me a moment to realize she was trying to draw them back. "I'm sorry," she said, her movements growing stronger. "I'm sorry. I can't." Again, I think I understood her just a beat too late. Or perhaps it was simply that, having got so far with her, I found myself suddenly desperate to see the thing through. I put down my hands and caught hold of her hips. With a violence which astonished me, she twisted free. For a moment we actually tussled. Then she drew in her knees and kicked out at me, blindly. Her heel caught my jaw, and I fell back. I think the blow must have stunned me for a second. I became aware of the jolting of the seats. I couldn't see her, but realized that she had put down her legs and was straightening her skirt, refastening her gown, doing it all with hasty, jerky movements as if almost panicked. But then she tightened the blanket around her and turned and moved away from me, shuffling over as far as the narrowness of the car would allow and putting her face against the window, pressing her forehead to the glass. And after that she was horribly still. I didn't know what to do for her. I reached, uncertainly, and just touched her arm. She flinched at first, then let me stroke her. but it might as well have been the blanket letting me do it, or the leather seat. She felt dead to my hand. I said miserably, "For God's sake, I thought you wanted it." She answered after a moment, "So did I." That was all she would say. So presently, embarrassed, uncomfortable, I drew my hand away and retrieved my hat. The windows of the car, with appalling comedy, had grown cloudy. I wound mine down, hoping to do something to relieve the atmosphere of intimacy and blunder. The night air came in like a flood of frigid water, and after a minute I felt her shiver. I said, "Shall I take you home, Caroline?" She didn't reply, but I started the engine. The sound was brutal in the silence, and slowly turned the car around. She began to stir only once we had rejoined the Hundreds Road and were running alongside the wall of the park. She roused herself properly as we drew up at the gates, tidying her hair, working her feet back into her shoes, but not looking at me. By the time I had got out to push the gates open and had climbed back in, she had removed the blanket from her shoulders and was sitting up straight and ready. I took us carefully along the frosty drive and around to the sweep of gravel. A couple of windows caught the light of the headlamps, sending it back with a soft, irregular sheen of oil on water. But the windows themselves were dark, and when I switched the engine off, the great house seemed somehow to edge closer until it was impossibly looming and forbidding against the densely starred sky. I reached for the catch of my door, meaning to get out and open hers. But she beat me to it, saying hastily, "No, please don't. I can manage. I don't want to keep you." There was no trace of drunkenness in her voice, no girlishness, but no upset either. She sounded slightly subdued, that was all. I said, "Well, I'll sit here and watch until you're safely inside." But she shook her head. "I'm not going in that way. Now Roddy's gone, Mother has Betty bolt the front door at night. I'm going in the garden way. I've brought a key." I said that in that case I would certainly go with her. So we both got out and started silently and awkwardly together past the shuttered library windows, then turned onto the terrace to go along the north side. It was so dark we had to make our way almost by trust. Now and then our arms touched, and we moved elaborately apart, only to step blindly onwards and find ourselves veering back together. At one point our hands met and snagged. She drew away her fingers as if scalded, and I winced, remembering that terrible little tussle in the car. The darkness began to feel almost stifling. It was like a blanket over one's head. When we rounded the next corner, and even the starlight was blotted out by the elms on that side of the house, I brought out my cigarette lighter and made a lantern of my palms. She let me guide her to the door, her key ready. Once the door was open, however, she stood on the threshold as if suddenly uncertain. The stairs beyond were faintly lit, but for a second after I had blown out my flame, we were blinder than we had been in the total darkness. When my eyes had readjusted, I could see that her face was turned to mine, but her gaze lowered. She said, quietly and slowly, "That was stupid of me before. The night had been such a nice one, too. I enjoyed our dances." She raised her eyes and might have said more, I don't know. At that moment the stairs were lit up properly, and she said quickly, "There's Betty coming down for me. I must go." She leaned to me and kissed my cheek, quite primly at first. Then, as the corner of her mouth overlapped with the corner of mine, she put up a hand to the side of my head and clumsily drew my face around. Just for a second, as our lips met, I felt a sort of tremor pass over her features, her mouth twitching and her eyes shutting tight. Then she moved away from me. She went into the house as if stepping through a rip in the night and instantly sealing it up behind her. I heard her key turn in the lock and caught the diminishing tap of her heels on the bare stone stairway, and somehow the loss of her made me want her plainly and physically more than the nearness of her had done. I stepped to the door and stood against it, frustrated, willing her to return. But she did not return. The silent house was closed to me, the tangled garden still. I waited another minute, and another, then slowly picked my way back through the almost impenetrable darkness to my car. Chapter 9. After that I didn't see her for more than a week. I was too busy. And to be honest, I was grateful for the delay. It gave me a chance, I thought, to sort through my feelings, to recover from my embarrassment at the blunders of the night, to tell myself that, after all, nothing much had passed between us, to put the whole thing down to the drink and the darkness and the giddy after-effects of the dance. I saw Graham on the Monday and made a point of mentioning Caroline's name, telling him she'd fallen asleep in the car on the way out of Leamington and had slept like a child until we reached the Hundreds Gate, and then changing the subject. As I think I've said before, I am not a naturally mendacious man. I've seen too many of the complications in the lives of my patients to which lies lead. But in this instance I thought it best to try and put a definite end to any speculation regarding Caroline and me. I thought this for Caroline's sake as much as my own. I rather hoped to run into Seeley. I planned to ask him, boldly, to do all he could to quash those rumours he'd mentioned, which suggested that I was romantically interested in one or both of the heir's women. Then I even began to wonder whether there really had been rumours. Couldn't the whole thing have been simply a tipsy piece of mischief on Seeley's part? I decided that it could, and when my path did at last cross his, I made no mention of the dance, and neither did he. But still, as that week ran busily on, I thought of Caroline often. The frosty weather grew wet again, but I knew that rain rarely kept her from walking. Taking my short cut across the park, I found myself looking out for her. I looked out for her, too, in the lanes around Lidcote, and was aware of a sense of disappointment at not seeing her. And yet, when an opportunity arose for dropping into the hall itself, I didn't take it. I realized, almost to my own surprise, that I was nervous. Several times I picked up the telephone, meaning to call her. Always I put the receiver down with the call unmade. Soon the delay began to feel unnatural. It occurred to me that her mother might start to think it odd that I was keeping away, and it was the prospect of inadvertently arousing Mrs. Ayres's suspicions as much as anything that sent me over there at last, for I found I almost dreaded them. I went out there on a Wednesday afternoon in a spare hour between cases. The house was empty, save for Betty happily cleaning brass at the kitchen table with the wireless on. She told me that Caroline and her mother were somewhere in the gardens, and after a brief search I discovered them making a gentle tour of the lawns. They were surveying the effects on the already untidy flower beds of some recent driving rains. Mrs. Ayres was well wrapped up against the damp and the cold, but seemed very much better than when I'd last seen her. She caught sight of me before her daughter did and came across the grass to greet me, smiling. Caroline, as if self-conscious, bent to the ground to pick up a sprig of slick, brown leaves. But when she had straightened, she followed her mother, meeting my gaze without a blush, and one of the first things she said to me was, "You've recovered, then, from all that dancing? My feet were killing me last week. You should have seen how we punished the parquet, Mother. We were rather splendid, weren't we, Doctor?" She was the squire's daughter again, her tone light, deliberate, seamless. I said, "We were," and had to turn away, unable to look at her, for it was only in that moment, feeling the sudden, violent dropping or dashing of something inside me, that I knew what she meant to me. All my careful reasoning of the past 10 days, I understood, was a sort of sham, a sort of blind thrown up by my own unsettled heart. She herself had done the unsettling, had raised a cloudy stir of emotions between us, and the thought that she might be able now to seal those emotions up— seal them up, for example, as she had sealed up her grief over Jip, was very hard to bear. Mrs. Ayres had moved away from me to examine another flower bed, and I went to her and offered my arm. Caroline joined her on her other side, and the three of us moved slowly on from one lawn to another, Caroline every so often stopping to pull up the worst of the battered plants, or to press the less damaged of them back into the soil. I don't know if she looked at me at all. When I glanced at her, she was looking ahead, or looking down, so that I saw mainly her flattish profile, and because we walked with Mrs. Ayres between us, her face was often partially or wholly hidden from me by her mother's. They talked a great deal about the gardens, I recall. The rains had brought a fence down, and they were debating whether or not it ought to be replaced. An ornamental urn had also become broken, and the large rosemary bush it held needed to be moved elsewhere. The urn was an old one, brought over from Italy as part of a pair by the Colonel's great-grandparents. Did I think it might be repaired? We stood and looked at the forlorn-looking thing, its bowl jagged and gaping, exposing a mass of tangled roots. Caroline squatted down beside it and gave the roots a prod.
"One half expects it to twitch," she said,
her eyes on the rosemary plant above.